Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm delighted to be joined today on Reboot Republic by Dr. Tricia Keelty, who is the head of social justice at St. Vincent de Paul and also an associate assistant professor in the School of Social Work and Social Policy in UCD. Tricia, thanks so much for joining me again on Reboot Republic.
Thanks, Rory. Thanks for having me on.
And just to remind our listeners that obviously, as you are well aware, we're covering a lot of issues at the moment, highlighting inequalities, highlighting issues around COVID, what can be done, what could be done, and broader social issues. And we know that lots of you are supporting us on patreon.com. We really appreciate that support. It helps pay the bills and keep these podcasts being produced. And if you aren't a Patreon supporter, please go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a patron supporter to keep us going. And a reminder, on the April the 9th in the evening, we're doing a celebration of Reboot Republic's 100 episodes of our second series. So we're delighted about that and looking forward to it. And if you want to become part of that, become a patron. So, Tricia Keelty, from St. Vincent de Paul, the report that you had out called Cutting Back and Falling Behind, an analysis of the financial impact of COVID-19, finds the headline describes a significant portion of Irish society are facing a multitude of financial pressures due to the pandemic, including loss of income, increased household expenditure on basics, erosion of savings to meet ordinary living expenses, falling behind on bills, and being forced to cut back on essentials like food, heating, and electricity, according to a Red Sea poll commissioned, research commissioned by St. Vincent de Paul. We've heard a lot, the thing I've heard most in terms of the media narrative around the whole COVID has been the amount of money people are saving and what this is going to mean in terms of, you know, increased demand in the housing market and the housing system. We haven't heard much about the rise in poverty or how people have been affected by poverty, have we?
Yeah, and that's exactly why we commissioned Red Sea to carry out this survey, which is of a representative sample of about 1,000 Irish adults, because we were hearing, you know, that this pandemic has allowed people to build up savings. People aren't spending money on commuting or holidays. You know, they're working from home, so their costs are less in a kind of for their social costs. But from our experience in our work in communities, you know, we're meeting a lot of people who were cutting back and really struggling with the extra costs that they're being faced with during school closures. So I suppose the purpose of this study was just to shine a light on that. And I suppose that the results are quite stark. So 2% of people said they've used savings to meet ordinary living expenses. So whether that's food, utilities or housing costs. A third of people said they had a loss of income. 38% had cut back on, 38% had an increased expenditure on basics, and a quarter had cut back on food and utilities during the pandemic. So I think that shows quite a significant proportion of the Irish population are struggling. And it's definitely a tale of two lockdowns. So on the one hand, you have people who are probably in a better financial position. And then on the other hand, you have people who are really, really feeling and bearing the brunt of it. And I think the most important finding for us was the people who were most at risk of poverty prior to the pandemic are feeling the most adverse impacts. So it finds that people who said they were struggling financially prior to COVID are more likely to have lost income, and they're more likely to have increased expenditure on basics, and they're more likely to be cutting back and falling behind on their bills. And in particular, we see lone parents and people with disabilities feeling the worst effects.
And in a way, though, you know, the I assume government would say, and, you know, we know that, you know, the in terms of the PUP payments that are in place, that, you know, social welfare hasn't been cut as such. Why are we seeing this?
Well, the biggest driver in our experience and what this survey shows is that if you're on a low income, you spend a bigger proportion of your income on basics like food and utilities. So if you're at home all day and you're using more gas and electricity and the kids are home and they're eating more, that has a big impact on your ability to make ends meet. And we also know that those who had the least kind of financial buffer have been hit hardest by job losses. So we know that lower paid sectors have experienced the biggest levels of unemployment, and also renters who would have been really struggling as well prior to the pandemic have been hit quite hard. And we find that a third of renters have had to cut back on basics in this survey, and almost one in 10 are behind on their rent, which is very worrying.
Yeah, they're very significant findings. And I think it's, and I know actually I saw, I don't know, this is a different poll than was commissioned in the Irish Times on the weekend, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yet it shows very, very similar figures between the two, that the Irish Times, the How Ireland Lives, I think it's they did it a year on. They showed similarly that around, I think it was 24% of people, or maybe you have the exact figure, I can't remember, are struggling. So it shows that that's one in four, you know, people, that's a quarter of our population are really struggling right now in the pandemic. And as you say, I suppose what the Irish Times poll didn't show was what you're highlighting, is that, because I had that question in my head about, well, are, you know, because people are saying they were financially impacted. Well, obviously, if they're financially impacted, that makes a massive difference if you've a high income and you've high savings. But if you're already in a difficult situation, then of course being impacted makes it much worse. Whereas what you're saying is it's those people who were already had low reserves or low incomes are the ones who have had to cut back.
Yes, and they've been hit hardest by the pandemic. And I think what that means now, which we're very worried about, is you're going to see a bigger divergence if there's not extra measures put in place in the next weeks and months, because you're going to see people who are being impacted, maybe ending up with long-term debt problems. Maybe they were on the brink of poverty prior to the pandemic and now being pushed in. And then you've got groups like people with disabilities and lone parents who had extremely high levels of poverty prior to COVID, who are now really, really feeling the impact. Like, one of the most striking statistics in the survey was that 42% of people with a disability had cut back on heat during the lockdown, which is
that's a shocking number.
Yeah. And a third of lone parents have fallen behind on their bills due to the pandemic. So, you know, there's a real risk now that people will end up in deeper poverty. And I suppose while the pandemic unemployment payment was set at a higher rate, I think that even highlighted more how inadequate our social welfare payments are. So people like disabilities and lone parents are expected to get by on 203, and they've had to deal with those extra costs, which means that they're being deprived in other areas even more than they would have already been prior to COVID.
Yeah, and in terms of, I think you know, that figure is astounding, that, you know, almost half of the people who had a disability, you know, were going without heating due to COVID, you know, over as a result of cuts like that, cut back on heating. That's just a striking figure. And, you know, that it is those who were already, as you say, at the higher rates of poverty. And it does absolutely, as you're right as well, you're right to highlight the inadequacy of existing welfare supports and welfare payments. And just maybe in terms of your own kind of, you know, work within St. Vincent de Paul, not you personally, but within St. Vincent de Paul that kind of brought you to do this research, what were you coming across, or what was being brought to you in terms of, you know, maybe you could explain to people a bit about the work that you do on the ground with people, and how those you would be coming across these situations, and what sort of situations were coming to you that made you do the research?
Yeah, I suppose SVP is an all-Ireland organisation. So we work in 8 regions across the country. And our main form of support is called home visitation, where we would visit people who have requested our help because they're experiencing financial difficulty or marginalisation. And we would provide support, either practical support, financial support, or make referrals. So at the start of the pandemic, we would have obviously had to change how we do our work because we couldn't visit people in their homes. Mm. So quite quickly, we were able to move things quite remotely. So now we'll meet with people when they request their help over the phone. We'll find out what's coming up, what are the issues, and then we'll try and provide support either through information over the phone or by maybe posting out food parcels or financial support as well. So that has worked quite well. And luckily, we've been able to respond to the requests that have come in. And I think during the initial lockdown in March last year, we would have seen a number of issues arising. Firstly, was that the loss of school meals for children had a big impact on family budgets. So in the decision by the government to continue school meals during school closures and throughout the summer was really welcome. But I think then in September, we started to see when the disconnection moratorium was lifted there for that period where we moved into level three. You know, we had a lot of people who had already built up energy debt. And we were concerned there at that point, you know, that was going to be a bigger issue, particularly as we headed into winter. And then when we came back after Christmas and schools were closed again, we were getting a lot more calls, particularly from people on prepay meters who just didn't have enough money to top up their meter and were sitting in the cold and the dark. So for one example, you know, we had a case where a family had just moved into a HAP property. They had a top up they had to pay. They were on social welfare as a lone parent family. They were putting about 80 euro in the meter every week, which is a huge amount of money when you're on a very low income, and then trying to pay the top up as well. So they were really struggling even to put food on the table. You know, that's kind of a very typical kind of case that we would see in Vincent de Paul. And then they were worried about their top up, and if they stopped paying the top up to the landlord, would they be at risk of becoming homeless again? And, you know, that constant worry for people and all this pressure that was added to households. And I suppose the second area that we were quite concerned about is the impact of online learning and the cost of online learning for families. So we did a survey in January of our local groups to see what type of issues again were coming up. And we had, you know, a lot of families who were cutting back on food because they paid for a digital device that, you know, was really expensive when they're on a low income. Even just access to broadband, access to space was a huge issue, particularly for families in overcrowded accommodation or unsuitable accommodation, and the impact that had on children as well. We were hearing quite a lot from families. And then the other group was, you know, people with disabilities living alone, trying to self-isolate, but just not being able to afford kind of an adequate level of comfort in their home in terms of food and heating.
I have to say, it sounds Dickensian, those, you know, what you're describing there, you know, families sitting at home in the dark, you know, or not in the dark, but with no heat. That is, you know, and you're saying this is typical of what you're seeing within St. Vincent de Paul.
Yeah. And in the dark sometimes, you know, people, no electricity, even not even money to top the electricity. So it's it is very stark, and it has been very hard on a lot of people, and even harder for people who, you know, are being pushed deeper into that now, and we're very worried about the long-term impact of it.
I could absolutely see that, and extremely worried. And it's interesting that, why do you think this hasn't got much coverage?
I think there is a prevailing view that because people who maybe their only income was from social welfare, you know, they haven't been impacted in any way because, you know, they haven't experienced job losses or things like that. And then it was really, we really had to work hard to communicate the impact it was having on household costs, and the fact that you're home more and you're heating more and the cost of food is more. So I suppose there was movement on extending the fuel allowance last March. Yeah. And we've written to the minister since January a few times to say it needs to happen again this January, February, because it's even worse now, because during the cold months, you know, people are going to be hit with very big bills, or they're going to have been cutting back more. So I think we're probably looking at significant energy debt in the coming weeks and months. And again, when we move out of level five, the disconnection moratorium will end as well.
And you're saying with the last level five that lifted before Christmas, that you saw the issue of disconnection debt being built up affecting people?
Yeah. And unfortunately, it'll probably be worse this time. But again, there is an opportunity to be proactive. And a lot of the suppliers are working with customers to put in place payment plans, for example, and that has been quite effective. But I think if there's significant energy arrears, people are going to need some sort of debt relief. And we're trying to kind of put that on the agenda in terms of our own advocacy work.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other area that you've highlighted then, which you've found, which is something that it was actually picked up also in the 2019 SILC, the Survey of Living Conditions Statistics, which looked at poverty and income inequalities in 2019, because we don't have figures yet for 2020, showed that renters were one of the few groups where poverty actually increased, where levels of deprivation increased in 2019. This is pre-COVID. So you're finding then that almost one in three renters, a third of renters, had to cut back on heating due to the costs. What sort of, you know, where do you see that coming from? Obviously, it's rents, but in terms of what's being brought to you, what are you seeing, and what did you find from the poll as well? In that regard?
So I think there's a lot of warning signs there in terms of renters. So the fact that almost one in 10 have already fallen behind on their rent due to COVID is quite worrying, and it really doesn't tally with the number of people who've registered with the RTB, the Residential Tenancy Board, in terms of people who are experiencing rent arrears due to COVID. So yeah, we're worried that the issue is a lot bigger than it's maybe been presenting in the Residential Tenancy Board. Because if you take 10% of, there's over 300,000 private rented tenancies, you know, that's could be a significant amount of people who are struggling to pay their rent. And then if you have on top of that people, you know, a higher percentage of renters said that they're struggling to pay other bills, that could, you know, be a knock-on impact. So if they're struggling in that domain, then they may be struggling more, maybe struggling in the future with their rent as well. And I think the area of deprivation, and particularly among HAP tenants, that's what we would see most frequently in our work. The issue of top-ups to meet market rents causes huge financial distress for households who are on a low income. And it's really very concerning that a lot of those households aren't protected in the COVID-related arrears protections that are in place at the moment.
Why are they not protected?
So, well, you would be protected. So if you were on the pandemic unemployment payment or on the temporary wage subsidy scheme. But if you're one of the families that we would visit who are on social welfare and are struggling to pay your top up because you've been hit by bigger bills, you wouldn't be protected under that legislation, because you aren't technically, your income hasn't been affected by COVID-19.
And in that context, then, there isn't supports in place once, and there's no supports in place
once the 5K rule is lifted and the blanket ban on evictions is gone. Then those households will be at risk of homelessness, which is in the middle of a pandemic, which is very, very concerning.
It is deeply concerning, and it's something that we raised before as well, before when the last time level 5 was lifted, just again in December, that this it is problematic, isn't it, that legislation that, you know, links the eviction ban, which is the essentially blanket ban on evictions, to the level 5 5 kilometer limit. Do you think?
Yes, to be honest, I can't really. It's supposed to be a public health measure, but if you're allowing evictions in level 4 when there's still a pandemic ongoing, it doesn't really make sense. And then it is obviously people want to go beyond their 5K, and I think there's a lot of push for that, but I don't think a lot of people know that that effectively means the eviction ban will end. And then the new legislation that's being brought through at the moment will actually allow evictions for non-COVID related rent arrears, even if the 5K measure is in place. So it's been watered down even further in the new bill, which again will cause problems for the households we're talking about.
Absolutely. And the figures in terms of, we've seen a welcome fall, you know, in the fat levels of family homelessness, and the, you know, people who are involved in that would say that the ban on evictions has been very central to that reduction.
Yeah, absolutely. So it just seems, it's just not right that you could allow evictions at this time, maybe putting people into emergency accommodation while there's a public health emergency, and just in any time, you know, when you can see how effective the eviction ban is at minimizing the trauma of child and family homelessness. And for those reasons alone, it should be seen as a priority. But unfortunately, I don't think it is.
And why do you think that isn't the case?
Why don't I think that is? It's a good question. And I think there is balancing of landlords' rights and responsibilities, and then the rights of tenants. And it's been slowly, during, at the height of the pandemic, it had tilted towards tenants for the first time in a long time. And now it's slowly tilting back to terms of landlords and their ability to, you know, make evictions for whatever reasons, or use their properties for whatever reasons, or rent increases for reasons that are necessary from their point of view. But yeah, it doesn't make sense if the government are serious about addressing homelessness, and we can see that this is working, why they wouldn't try and, you know, continue that until the homeless numbers are down even further.
And have ye made representations to the minister and the government on this?
Yes, we wrote to the minister in September, again, when level five was lifting, specifically around the rent arrear cases that we're talking about, that we said these are not going to be covered by the legislation that's been brought in, and there's going to be lots of families, and very vulnerable families, who are going to fall through the cracks, and there will be an increase in homelessness as a result. And so there wasn't really any kind of response to that, but it was something that we have raised.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. Did you get a response?
No.
It's exasperating, whatever word you want to put on it, to think, as you say, that in the middle of a pandemic, yes, you're going from level five to some other version of level five, and you're going to remove an eviction ban that is keeping people from homelessness. When, as you say, we know the damage, the huge damage that homelessness does to families, and in particular children. It seems to me that we still don't do social policy from a rights-based perspective in this country, do we?
No, we don't. And I think that's really come to the fore during the pandemic, in terms of just the level of people's basic fundamental human rights not being upheld, in terms of access and right to accommodation, adequate standard of living. And you know, that's when people fall through the cracks. And you have at the moment now, you can see it in just the complex two pieces of legislation that are in place to deal with the issue of evictions during a pandemic. And obviously a right to housing would overcome that imbalance, because I think a lot of the concerns, they say it's constitutional in terms of having an eviction ban for economic reasons rather than public health reasons. And it's definitely leading to people being put in a very, very vulnerable position. And you know, we don't know how or when we're going to see the ramifications of that, but we will see it unless we have better safeguards for people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's absolutely clear that, you know, if they're saying the Constitution is the reason why they, you know, they can't keep in place the, you know, eviction moratorium, the ban on evictions, and clearly the Constitution does need to change, and that, you know, that balancing of the rights of private property, we need a right to housing put in there, you know, in the Constitution.
Absolutely, yeah.
And just on the report, you said that these findings point to a divergence in experience during lockdown, with those most vulnerable to financial strain and poverty feeling the brunt of the negative economic consequence of the pandemic. And you say, while the government policy response has mitigated significant income losses through the pandemic unemployment payment and wage subsidy schemes, the data shows that additional interventions for those most at risk of financial distress are needed to ensure the public health crisis is not followed by a deeper debt, homelessness and poverty crisis. What are some of those interventions do you think are needed?
Well, the first one is that we would like to see the blanket ban on evictions extended by at least 6 months, or at least until the pandemic has ended, under review then afterwards. We'd also like to see a rent arrears fund or debt relief set up. So, for example, if you qualify for the Residential Tenancy Board protections and you engage with the process where you will engage with the Money Advice and Budgeting Service, you may set out a payment plan with your landlord. But if there's a gap there between what you owe and what the landlord is required in terms of rent, there's a gap there and that needs to be filled. And there also could be potential to prevent thousands of people becoming homeless, even if it's, you know, people could have rent arrears from €100 and end up homeless, which would cost the state 35,000 every year. So it makes a lot of sense to be proactive and preventative in terms of helping people who have no capacity to repay their rent arrears and by establishing a debt relief, a rent relief fund. The second is in relation to fuel allowance. We'd like to see that extended by 2 weeks at least, and that would give people some extra funds there to maybe pay off bills. We also want suppliers to look at ways that they can maybe have debt write down for energy, significant energy debt, and that could also be co-funded by the government as well. And then we also, I suppose, just it underlines how we need to build the financial resistance of households after the pandemic. So it really just shows how important a living wage is for people and adequate social welfare as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think they're really good ideas. And you know, again, we have to hope that, you know, people will hear them and put pressure behind them, been put in place. One thing just on the disabilities and people, those with disabilities, why in particular are we seeing such a high level in terms of the impact on them, do you think?
I think it's been greater levels of self-isolation and being home more, because if they have health concerns as well from COVID. So you have inadequate social welfare. So 203 is inadequate for a single adult. A single adult needs 245 to afford a week, to afford a minimum essential standard of living. But a person with a disability has extra costs that aren't factored in. So you may have, there's a whole range of different cost of disability, depending on the type of disability, whether it's sensory, physical. You have extra costs that other people don't have to support you in with your needs. So that obviously there's a much bigger gap for someone with a disability already in terms of income adequacy, and then you pile on the additional pressures of COVID, which exacerbate those.
I think that it seems to me that within this pandemic, while there's all this talk of being in it together, as you said, it's like a tale of two lockdowns, that, you know, if you are already vulnerable and in a way hidden, that people in poverty and, you know, situations of lone parents, people with disabilities have been even more hidden or forgotten about.
Yeah. And I thought it would be easier for people to kind of recognize the difficulties people have when they are living in poverty, because we all kind of feel trapped at the moment, or a bit disconnected and excluded and isolated. And I think a lot of people do, but I suppose it's just all that isolation, all that loneliness that some people in poverty experience has just been way more pronounced for people. And I think after the pandemic, I hope there's some more solidarity in terms of the issues that people have faced. But it'll be a very, very difficult few years and months ahead. But hopefully, I suppose what we're saying now is that, you know, the end is near, and government should be doing all that they can to prevent kind of a deeper poverty crisis.
Yeah, it seems to be. And I think it's that question of, you know, what's prioritized, and what's prioritized in the discussions as well in the national, I think, policy dialogue. And it's, to me, that again, that voice seems absent, that voice of those who are affected, you know, most deeply. And it seems to me that, again, it's highlighting our kind of policy inadequacies and the structures that aren't in place to have that voice been brought forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was reading in the UK, what campaigners are pushing for over there is, you know, if the government are planning on doing an inquiry into how COVID was handled, but also look at how poverty was exacerbated in the UK as well during COVID, and what could have been done and what we need to do now. So something like that would be really welcome, you know, to shine a light on it, to say, look, these issues have been exacerbated, but it doesn't mean that, you know, it's insurmountable afterwards to deal with it. You can help people, and it's really hopefully we can build back better and, you know, once and for all address poverty. But I think there's a serious challenge lying ahead now, unfortunately.
Yeah. And in terms of St. Vincent de Paul, how are you approaching that now in terms of, you know, trying to influence or trying to change it? What's your kind of messages you're trying to bring forward?
Well, I suppose there's the immediate short-term issues in terms of debt and financial distress that could be addressed quite easily and at quite low cost, if you think about the longer term costs of poverty and pushing people into poverty that we've sought to highlight. So we published a report last year which showed that every year the state spends about $4.5 billion dealing with the consequences of poverty on people's lives. So making key investments now that prevent people falling into poverty in the first place is really money well spent, along with all the moral reasons why you would do so. So that continues to be our kind of message to government. And then I think, again, just how vulnerable our society was to this impact. So, for example, you mentioned there at the start, a third of people were finding it difficult or just about getting by, and were on, you know, the cusp of serious financial difficulty prior to COVID. Why is that? And how can we better support people and households to have a decent standard of living, security in their homes, being able to afford adequate heat, light and food, and their children able to enjoy the same level of education, regardless of where their parents are from or who they are, and that this massive educational divide isn't so prevalent in our society as well. So it's trying to, you know, utilize and show how it has exposed those and say, look, we need to do better than this. And I think it's not going, we need a reboot, not a recovery. So it's trying to restart things and not just going back to the old ways of doing things and hope for the best. We have to reshape and reboot everything, I think. But I might be overly optimistic about that, but we have to be.
We absolutely do have to be. We do, because the alternative is things getting much worse. And that, you know, we can't allow that to happen.
No, absolutely not.
You know, it's and I think that the what you've set out there, you know, in terms of even the theme of this podcast, reboot, I like that. Reboot, not, you know, we need a reboot and a reshaping, not a recovery in a sense. And that's, you know, it's not about returning to the old normal. And I think, you know, your findings are deeply, for me, deeply disturbing to see that level of poverty and, you know, distress been pushed back on those most vulnerable in society. It's really, it's not acceptable, you know, in the midst of a pandemic, when we are supposed to be pulling together as a society, and we're supposed to be thinking about, you know, what the values we have and what type of society we have. It's supposed to move us away from that, you know, and towards a more inclusive society.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And that it's like, You know, I find it, it's how can we shift? How can we shift the thinking on it? It seems, you know, that we need an even bigger frame of thinking to me. I don't know. What do you think? How can we reshape this thinking?
I don't know. And I think there was definitely more openness in the dialogue and discussion about this at the start of the pandemic. Mm. And I feel like that's kind of moved away. And I think there's a shift back to the old way of thinking. We're talking about national debt again. And, you know, a return to austerity would be an absolute disaster for the people that we assist in terms of what the last crash did to people. But I suppose in terms of shifting that, there is, you know, a lot of focus from a lot of organisations, but also a lot of policymakers as well that we would meet with. They do realise that, you know, we can't go back to the old way of doing things. And one thing that we've always called for and we'd love to see, and I think it's more important than ever, is a joint Oireachtas committee on inequality and poverty. So that it's kept on the agenda in the Oireachtas as an issue that we need to monitor very carefully and closely, and that it requires the buy-in, cross-party buy-in and support. We have the Roadmap for Social Inclusion, which is the national strategy to tackle poverty, but it was published prior to the general election and obviously prior to COVID. So that will all need to be reshifted and refocused, given the unprecedented impact it has had on people in poverty. But we have targets there. You know, we've looked to other countries who've sought to legislate against their poverty targets, which again has shown in particular, New Zealand has shown leadership in that regard. They have a minister responsible for child poverty. So you kind of need it at that level and accountability throughout the political and policy system.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think they're really good ideas that, you know, you've highlighted before, and we need to keep pushing them and get them onto the agenda, get them delivered. Tricia Keelty, thanks so much from St. Vincent de Paul. Thanks so much for joining me today in Reboot Republic. That was really, I suppose, important that people hear this. Really important.
Thank you very much.
And a reminder to our listeners that you can become a supporter of ours if you can. We put an appeal to you. Go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack, become a supporter. These podcasts cost to produce. And of course, also please support organizations like St. Vincent de Paul, who are doing incredible work. And in terms of if people want to support St. Vincent de Paul, Tricia, what should they do?
You can make a donation on our website, svp.ie, and we really, really appreciate any type of support that we can get. So we really rely on the generosity of the public. So thanks very much.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know there's so many people who do help out. And it is, I think in many ways, you know, it's a reshaping of society through different values as well. And those values of social justice are so important. That should be at the cornerstone of our society and what we do. And that's what we are building towards. So thank you. And a reminder to our listeners, we are doing Reboot 100 live on the evening of Friday, the 9th of April. If you're interested in getting involved, go over to patreon.com, sign up and become a supporter and get involved. And we're looking forward to it. So we will talk to you all soon. Thank you very much.